Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sync Call for the 1st of February, 2017. Let's get started by looking at RFCs, because I know there's one that I want to talk about. So, first, for support streaming in the HTTP package, number 71. Can anybody hear me?
Yeah.
Phew! we've got that Mark Dez ready to vote. PD2Notes says he thinks that the interface is stable. I think let's merge it. What do you think?
Sure, let's go for it.
Awesome. Excellent. But, of course, the one that I want to talk about is number 76. So, have you guys read through numbers? I know Joe's read through number 76. Has anyone else read through? Okay.
Yeah, I was looking at it a bit earlier today.
All right, cool. Awesome. Although I have posted a long thing about problems with this RFC, it doesn't mean I'm actually opposed to the idea behind the RFC, because I'm not. It's that there are complex issues around stateful exceptions that I think we're not addressing by just returning any old damn thing. But I'm perfectly willing to be convinced otherwise. I'm not kidding about that, even though I posted something rather long and negative. And I'm hoping somebody has something they can do to convince me that this is all fine. Anyone? Joe?
I mean, let's see. My position on the change, I guess, has been I called out a couple things specifically that I would not have wanted to see in it if it went through. I think those were already adjusted and kind of taken account for. As far as the general like motivation behind this, I don't know. I personally, I'm not totally convinced about the motivation outweighing some of the downsides that that Sylvan brought up in the comments, the long comment that he read. Specifically, I think it is it is pretty weird that the question mark for partial function under this change would just basically mean that it could return the given return value or raise anything at all that has the val capability. And there's no way to be more specific than that or like outlaw more than that. And it feels very much like a language where you ignore the type except for at runtime. So it definitely doesn't feel like a type safe language. When you get into that, especially when you think about the fact that somebody could refactor the implementation of something, change, but the interface would not be changed. But now they're raising a different error value out of it. You wouldn't have any kind of indication that the contract changed, other than reading through documentation. Or the code if there is no change documentation for it.
Yeah.
And also the more I kind of look at the sort of else error paradigm of like, here are the things I know how to handle, and here are the things that and anything else I don't know how to handle, so just raise it up. The more I kind of think about how that would be applied in the real world, I think it really turns a lot of the positive things about the way Pony programs are guaranteed to address errors as close to the possible as close to the raise as possible. I think it kind of turns that paradigm on its head, where now errors are, you know, like, oh, I know how to deal with these ones, but anything else, I'm just going to throw up my hands, and suddenly kind of everything becomes a partial function. And you're in a world full of partial functions, and any of them could return any value at all.
Which is exactly how languages like C# and F# work, where any function could raise an exception. You have no indication whether a function might or might not raise an exception, and it could be of any value. Which is not my favorite thing about .NET.
Yeah, and I mean, I do have to admit there have been times when I wanted, you know, I've said that, oh man, I wish I could raise an error value here. There have been times when I've said that, but then again, one of the things that I think is really attractive about Pony is that it is, I guess some people call it opinionated, in that there are things that you sometimes want to do that Pony won't let you do for the reason of making your programs ultimately easier to reason about. So it kind of like Pony has a bunch of intentional roadblocks put up
yes,
to make you kind of to stop you in your tracks when you're addressing a problem in a way that is going to make the overall program less easy to reason about. I guess if you choose Pony, you're doing it at least in part because you think that those roadblocks are useful to you. And so if you're not frustrated with Pony sometimes, then that means you're kind of like already perfect.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty good explanation of exactly how I feel, as well as a nice explanation of how you feel. Okay. In that case, Ben was not on the call, so of course we'll discuss this further with him, because it's his RFC. And I'm also super keen to have anybody else's input on this if they have anything at all. But what Joe just said is a really excellent summary of exactly how I feel about it.
And I'm glad you spoke up on the ticket, because I was kind of inclined to say, oh, well, as long as these one or two details are cleaned up, but your comment got me thinking more about the kind of ramifications.
Cool. Good. I didn't want to come off as too much of a jerk there.
No, I don't think you did. I mean, that's why we have this RFC process, is that it kind of it's intended to make everyone kind of take back, you know, step back and take a closer look at things.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome.
And I'm still like you. I'm still open to, you know, if there are good solutions to these problems, I'm, you know, happy to look at those. And you know, I.
I mean, in the spirit of thinking about how all sorts of languages have handled this, coroutines are another way to handle non-local returns. I'm not going to say that's a really popular way. I think there are just a few languages like Racket that can express that. I think one of the patterns that I can't remember who came up with for Pony that I think is quite interesting. I'm not sure we've seen a lot of it in the wild, but I think it's an interesting pattern, is the idea of passing in an error handling function.
That's one that I asked him to add to the RFC, the third option there under motivation.
Yeah. And that still seems to me an extremely interesting thing to think about encouraging, especially as we get better and better Lambda syntax and that kind of stuff becomes easier and easier to do. I mean, you can even be obviously for asynchronous stuff, you're not gonna have that thing pass state back to the caller. But for synchronous stuff, you absolutely could. That could be a lambda that actually closes over some mutable state that you can then go and pick up. So there's all kinds of interesting things you could do instead that would still give you this behavior, because you could set the error handling and then raise an exception so that there was no need to check the result until you knew there was an error. And then you would go into the passed in sort of notifier and pull out what you needed without paying the cost when no error was raised. And then that gives sufficiently complex error handling in both a good way and a bad way to cover all the points that I raised, in the sense that it really does accept only certain kinds of errors, because you passed in an error function that only accepts certain kinds of errors. Problem solved. It's completely type checked. If someone extends something, they're going to have to figure out how to either change that API or wrap their thing in something that you understand. If there are nested exceptions, well, either you'll understand them or you won't, but at least there's a defined API. Anyway.
Yeah, I think what we might be, you know, and I would say that these three distinct idioms that Benoit brought up in the RFC, I mean, he said that having different ways of doing almost the same thing isn't good for the overall consistency of the language and libraries. I mean, I would kind of argue that these are just kind of, they're different tools for solving slightly different problems. None of them is exactly what a lot of people are used to when it comes to exceptions, but they all have their strengths and weaknesses that you can use them in that situation. Yeah. Like, you know, the valueless errors are great for a function where you can say, oh, this, if an error is raised, it means this every time.
Yeah. For example, out of bounds on an array. You do an apply on an array, it can't give you an answer. It's because it doesn't exist. We're done.
Yeah, and that can just live in the documentation, saying, you know, this is what the error means if you see it.
Yeah.
It means the same thing every time. And I think the notifier is a very interesting idiom, and I think what we might be lacking is just sort of like some like community cohesion or like patterns or guidance about what that should look like, you know, best practices for integration with different libraries, and it just kind of needs more evolving around conventions.
That's a really good point. I wonder if the file package might be a nice place to experiment with that, because I'm underwhelmed with the changes that we've made for file. I think we all are, right? Using those primitives for open file and create file, I don't ever, because it turns out I don't want that behavior, and I really would prefer if create just raised an error, or open just raised an error. And maybe we could experiment with passing in a lambda to create an open on file that pulls out an error when an exception is raised, and then defaulting that lambda to some primitive that does nothing, so that you're not paying any cost to instantiate anything when nothing's going to happen, when you're not interested in the result.
Yeah, I think that might be a good place to start.
Yeah.
Regarding lambda syntax, I mean, you mentioned lambda syntax getting better. That's one of my primary goals. Every time I come back to, having time to work on Pony, one of the major goals I have is getting us to a point where we can have the lambda be a lot less syntax intensive for cases where you're passing it. Basically, being able to infer the lambda type for cases where you're passing it into a function that, or I guess assigning it, to where the type is already defined by the function you're passing it into.
Yeah.
And you could implicitly you have the right argument types, and it can make it very concise for inline invocations of things.
Yeah.
To be able to just say, here's the error, take a lot of the boilerplate out of it.
I agree. The other thing that I really like to do eventually is get to the point where we don't have to specify captures. That if we use stuff from out of the scope, we do a pass and figure out how to infer captures where we can. So that closing over stuff doesn't involve any extra notation when it isn't necessary.
Yeah. But you'd still have the option to
give
it a different name for cases where you have to.
Exactly. Or, you wanted to set some slightly different capability when you captured it, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, because, like, for example, because you have to get it to be sendable.
Right. Yeah. And then the other thing, part of that, that I've thought about on occasion is, if Lambda syntax got super extra, super good, and we could figure out when Lambdas were being assigned to things or not being assigned to things, so that we could make clever decisions about memory allocation, even on Lambdas that capture stuff. So even if it has captures, if there's only ever one instance of it, right, we could put it on the stack. And then you could do things like say that the body of a while loop could be a lambda. Instead of the current thing was saying while expression do sequence end, you could have while expression do expression, and that expression, if you needed something quite complex, could be a lambda.
Or as we've talked about in the past, some of the maybe this plus some compile time values from the and the type work that mm-hmm. Luke is doing could go part way at least towards some macros.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, where you start getting into really simple laziness, if we do this well enough, where we can just say, hey, if you just put it in brackets, braces, if we can infer a lot of stuff, then any expression in braces could be inferred as a lambda taking no arguments and returning the result of that expression, and you've just made a lazy version of any expression.
Yeah, and that's where I'd really like to get to is having that level of inference, and which should be fairly easy, at least in the case where you're passing it to a function or assigning it to something, right? Because the type you're expecting is already defined, and you just have to check that it is possible for the thing you're creating to become that type.
Exactly. With the one extra bonus of, oh wait, none? Cool. We'll just slap none at the end.
Yeah.
And then it's in there. All right, cool. I really could talk about lambdas all day, it turns out. But we should probably
only 23 hours and 40 minutes to go.
Well, see, you laugh, but I spent most of today at work talking about lambdas.
Oh, okay.
In a different context, but yeah.
Yeah, and I guess all day, it doesn't have to be 24 hours. It could just be the daytime hours.
Or work day, right? That's a kind of day. All right. Coolio. All right. Are there any other RFCs that people want to go over? Like, I wanted to go over 76, even though it's not marked ready for vote or anything. So if anyone has anything they want to go over, that's fine, of course.
I don't think there's anything that's very recent.
Okay. In that case, Unfortunately, Theo's PR has not finished its checks because I want to merge it so bad.
Yeah, Travis has been down with like BOSX stuff for like 2 days.
Oh.
It's just now starting up again. They're okay. Having issues.
Darn thing. Because, it's already passed one of its checks on OSX though, so it shouldn't be too long now.
Oh, good.
Yeah, although they are running pretty slow. 11 minutes to do a check just for one OSX platform. Ouch. So I haven't even looked. Did you use Makefile magic to figure out when default yes. Py?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Nice. Excellent. That will totally work. Nice.
Yeah, well, it worked on my Linux box, both with GCC, which, you know, since I'm using Ubuntu, just didn't work originally, and also with Clang, which doesn't even have the enable default Py option. So it works.
Ah, very cool. Right. So you actually get the options and grep through them rather than, that's very smart.
So I guess this is probably just an extension of a current problem that we already have. But I just wanted to mention it. I think, you know, this stuff like this where we're detecting stuff in the make file about where the compiler is going to live. Some of it we've seen break on situations where we're, you know, compiling the compiler and pushing a release up to bin tray and someone else is downloading it and their situation is not the same.
Yep.
Is there anything special we want to do for this PR in that case, or is it already as good as it's going to get in that regard?
I hadn't considered that. I don't know any way of doing that.
So which is the safer option for a case where we're building a release? Like it default Py or not default Py, which would be safer for a release built on bintray?
You know what? I think the issue is that not all compilers accept NoPy as an option. If they did, then this would just always pass it, problem solved.
So you don't think this matters when compiling?
I do think it matters, unfortunately. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, because Clang does not accept NoPy.
Yeah.
And we're invoking sometime downstream of the bin tray, like somewhere within Pony C when somebody runs it, it's invoking Clang.
So GCC 6 is interesting. Is this really doing this? It's when I give GCC 6 on OSX NoPy, and it's actually GCC 6, it's not Clang pretending to be something. It says unrecognized command line option NoPy. Did you mean NoPy? Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to paste that because it's worth pasting. I suspect this is a GCC on OSX bug. Because there are a lot of those. Because, of course, all code on OSX is position independent. So that's, you know, that's straightforward. We don't have a problem on OSX. But it is a strange result. Oh, Joe, your point is too good.
Sorry.
I mean, the brutal thing to do would be to run, would be to do that grep.
Oh, no.
At runtime.
I know exactly what you're thinking.
Yeah. But that just is so wrong. But I mean, how else are we going to figure out what the linker supports?
So this would happen every time you're compiling a Pony program?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, but if you compiled six programs on the same command line, it'd only do it once. But since no one, literally nobody ever does that except me.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Depending on grep to be available.
So, I'm looking at the status of LLD, which is the LLVM linker that's supposed to save us from this hell. Oh, interesting. They've separated out the core problem that they had in writing a single linker that did both ELF and COF. They have punted on it. Now they have separate ELF and COF linkers that seem to be making significant progress. Including being faster than gold. I'm posting a link to this for posterity. It's just lld.llvm.org. This is a much larger change and something I'm not saying should substitute for Theo's nice small PR. But we could look at getting away from trying to use the system linker or the system compiler and actually linking from inside PonyC using this library.
That's interesting.
Which would get us off the nonstop problems we have had with linker flags. Well, it's not nonstop, just recurring, I suppose. They're claiming that COF is, i.e. Windows support, is actually looking really good. And that ELF support is able to link things like Clang. And if you don't use linker scripts, you ought to be all right. We definitely don't use linker scripts.
Don't use linker scripts and we don't want.
Yes, exactly. If you are in a situation where you need one, then I can't help you. Including, wow, it looks like FreeBSD may adopt LLD as the system linker. Anyone interested in trying this?
I might be interested in trying this.
Awesome. Well, that would be particularly cool. And in fact, if we were using this, then we could we could certainly move towards preferring the bytecode version of the runtime library.
That is true.
Which I think would be probably, for a lot of programs, a pretty easy way to get a 2-3% performance improvement. Wow, they can link Chrome with debug info in 15 seconds, which is a 2 GB link job with 13 million relocations.
Wow. So you're saying it's pretty good.
I'll say, I mean, wow, that's extraordinarily good. Yeah, if you're up for this, Theo, this, I think this would be a really cool thing to do.
All right.
And would actually properly solve the problem.
So then the question is, do we even merge this PR?
That's a good question.
Considering the problem with the deployment.
Yeah, where this would absolutely work for people building locally, and as Joe points out, basically would make the system your compiler was built on determine whether this was set or not, regardless of whether you needed it.
Yeah. Which I would argue we already do for a lot of other stuff, by the way.
That's true.
But at the same time, I don't know. One thing I would mention is that I think Sean wanted to do a release sometime soon. The monthly releases goal.
Yep.
And so, and what I was meaning was that doing a release just after this change could have a bunch of people come back to us and say, hey, I updated the latest version. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
As opposed to if we did it just after a release, at least we'd get the benefit of people saying, oh no, then they're not going to be downloading. Oh, Lord. Because then what we don't get is information about how that it would propagate.
And we don't release off of master yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're already doing things in the makefile, like picking. Well, but see, we're picking AR, but then we're not using AR once we've built. The core problem is those things that we use once we've built.
Yeah, so I think the better option is to not do this.
Okay.
Considering it's probably worse to do this in that case than just saying, you know, just compile with pick.
Yeah. Okay. Damn it. I wanted this to just go.
I'll look into LLD.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. Sounds good. Thanks, Joe. I think you just saved us from a boo-boo.
I'm sorry.
No, okay. It's good. Okay, 1545 is marked as needs discussion.
Oh, yes. So
I think because you wanted Theo to weigh in.
Anyone who wants to weigh in as well. And Sylvan, you might have some input on what to do here. Basically, the situation is in a previous PR 1516, which Theo, Theo, have you already read through this, by the way?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Yeah. So, Sylvan, have you already read through it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, basically, the Does anybody have an option to propose other than the two options that I specified in the comment? One, to do a refactor of match type to return more information about why the deny was returned, or two, select a better generic error message and use that for every case of deny.
So my initial thought is both, which is start with the generic message you propose, or maybe we can come up with a different one, but although I think that one's pretty good. And I think a comprehensive refactor would be a good thing and a nice task if someone wanted to really, really get to grips with the type system, because there are some things that match type currently denies that in fact it should accept. And that's quite interesting, because match type, you want it to be able to reject things that can never happen, as well as things that should not be allowed to happen because of capabilities. But pretty much if it can't determine one of those other two things, it should allow it. And there are cases with complex generics with type parameters and things like that where that doesn't work right. Like if you have a value which the compiler knows is an array of A, and you ask it, is this an array of U8? It will say, no, it's an array of A. But actually, it might be an array of U8 if that's a possible bounds for A. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I'm trying to type out some notes about what you're saying.
Ah, cool. And I think the other thing that makes the reason I thought of this is because I really liked the way you stated about comprehensively returning information about what caused the deny. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you could do is, while gathering that information, is also use that to comprehensively gather information about matched types, even on an accept, and use that as the core of implementing exhaustive match.
You clever dog.
And with the caveat, of course, that exhaustive match can be determined for types. Absolutely. That's awesome. It can be determined for some sets of values, like Booleans, not that hard. Possibly integers. But then you get into anything that's remotely big, you're not going to have specified a separate case for each one. You're going to have used guards. And as soon as you get into guards, it's much trickier to determine that there's an exhaustive match. It's not technically impossible, but I suspect that the right first approach is to treat it as impossible.
Yeah, and... I agree. Yeah, I won't go any further than that.
Yeah.
Okay. It looks like our eager PR contributor, Token Rove, has said that he would be interested in possibly taking a look at attempting this refactor, although I expect that we're going to want to give him some guidance about what the refactor should look like.
Yeah,
and what the, you know, what to study while doing it, what to keep an eye out for, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So maybe you could make a to-do note, Sylvan, at some point to kind of to come back and think of some guidance to give.
Cool.
Put it here on this ticket.
Yeah. Okay. Will do. I think also. I think that's hard enough that it would be difficult to answer stuff up front. And maybe the right thing to do is we just say, if you're going to do this, please, 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 lots of questions.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's in some ways I'm loath to give. This sounds stupid, but loath to give too much guidance up front because I'm the person who wrote this version of match type, and I think I did a frankly not very good job, and I don't want to bias someone into doing a job as bad as I did. So, yeah.
Okay. So do you have any inkling right now about like what the return value should look like? Or is that one of the things that you prefer just to see what arises from somebody looking at it, an independent set of eyes?
I think the return value. Well, that's interesting. Because for exhaustive match, what we're really trying to do at the end is say, here's the union type of all possible matches. Is that also is the upper bounds of the value type a strict subtype of that union type? And now that you put it that way, now I'm starting to think maybe that information is actually already available from the AST without having to extract it during match type. Because you sent those types in the first place.
Right, but they could be, as you mentioned, they could be, you know, behind type parameters or, like, for example, if you have if you're trying to match on array A, mm-hmm. And you have the possibilities of array, you know, U8 or array whatever, and you determined in match type that those were within that U8 and whatever were within the bounds of A,
right?
Then that's something you would want to pass on, right? It's something you don't have already.
Yeah.
Without doing the same kind of recursion that match type is doing.
That's true. Yep, that's a good point.
So, I mean, but maybe it would be cleaner. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it would be cleaner to implement, you know, a second function that does the same kind of recursion that match type does, but with a different purpose. I don't know if it would be or not, but, I mean, it would take more time, more compile time, but if it's a cleaner implementation, it's probably worth it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when we're not, basically anytime we're not actually allocating AST nodes, whatever we're doing hardly counts against compile time. Compared to allocation and LLVM code generation. Okay. Yeah. I think that what you've done here is good. For a thing, maybe we can just add. I'll just add. Yeah. All right. In that case, it's 21:16, so we probably have time for a couple more. I don't think we can go through make IP address equatable because Sean isn't here. However, 1525, looks like it's good to go. We should merge it. Does that look right?
Let's see. I guess the do not merge label is removed. Okay. If it looks right to you, that's fine.
Basically, what it is there's, just to walk through it, there's a separate trailing zeros on a long for Windows ILP 32 because it should be a UINT32T, which is totally true. And similarly, in fun.c, it uses CLZL instead of CLZ. And there's there was an assumption that was wrong for ILP32 in the pool allocator where constant size of 64 was being used, which is not right, and it's been fixed. And then a bunch of the pool.c defines are lifted into pool.h, and that's so that pool.cc can get a hold of them in order to add a bunch of tests. So I'm going to go ahead and merge it. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, that sounds fine.
All right, cool. Excellent. Okay, is there anything else that anyone wants to cover? Specific issues, anything like that? Excuse me. 1531.
Yeah, I was going to mention that if no one else mentioned anything.
Yeah. Something that would save a lot of memory allocation, like a ton of memory allocation, would be to force ASTs, once they're allocated, to be truly immutable and reference count them.
Oosh.
Because they are a strict tree, so that would be completely safe. And that way a dupe is just a reference count increment. And if we go through and change it, we'd only have to allocate for nodes that were actually changed. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it just sounds like the reason I said oosh was you're talking about refactoring the entire compiler to not mutate the AST?
No. Go ahead and mutate the AST. Just
copy on write. Okay.
Copy on write on individual AST nodes. Another issue is that we doubled our memory requirement somewhere along the line with AST nodes. Because there's this UINT32T flags hanging off the end. And it means that instead of being a 64-byte structure, it's a 68-byte structure. So instead of being able to allocate it in 64 bytes, we allocate it in 128 bytes. So we could probably roughly have our memory requirements if we could shave 4 bytes off that structure.
That's interesting. Okay, so something I was wondering, kind of unrelated to memory usage, but I was wondering whether it would be a good idea to, because there are some flags that are only used within a single pass.
Yes.
Right. So there's no use carrying from them from pass to pass. They're just taking up space, and also they're creating extra state on the AST in other passes where it's not necessary. And in fact, you know, if you remember this like idea we had a while ago about porting the compiler to Pony in passes and passing AST between each, you know, between different tools that represent different passes of the compiler. I quickly had discovered that there's a lot of extra state within the AST that's not strictly AST.
Right.
And I was wondering if it would what you thought about a solution of like for cases where we have flags that are used within a that are, you know, set and read from within a single pass. Looking at those like from a perspective of like setting up a hash table at the start of the pass and where the references to AST nodes are the keys and the flag set are the values. And just anytime you want to know, hey, does this AST node have this flag? You check it in that table.
I think that's one of those things that would have to be tested for performance to find out, because you'd pay a lot higher cost to determine if the flag was set, including if it wasn't set.
Mm-hmm.
And that could add up. And if you add a lot of nodes end up having a flag set, you'll actually use a lot more memory that way, because you'll have these hash map entries taking up, you know, 32 bytes a go.
But at the same time, I feel like, I don't know, at least for some flags
that are rarely set, it could be.
Yeah, like for example, ones that are set only on references. If you look at the entire AST for a program, not many of the nodes are references.
Yeah. But then if there are some that are set often, then we need the flags field, and there's no point in saving on it if there's any of them that we need a lot. Does that make any sense? Did I make any sense?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And I guess maybe the data... That data blob that sits in the AST struct could be used for this if it's not being used for anything else in that particular path.
In fact, it used to be that it was, and Andy McNeil got quite annoyed at how often the pointer versus the flags were being conflated, and he went through and just separated them out, which made perfect sense at the time, because since we didn't have an annotation field, we had 8 bytes spare.
Okay.
We used 4 of them for flags, but now that there's an annotation field, we've popped over the horizon there.
Annotation
field. Yep.
I wonder,
Now, there's a thing that doesn't exist very often.
Yeah, like I wonder if the annotations could exist as a, some other structure where they exist outside the AST, but point to the AST or are pointed to by the AST.
It would be pretty straightforward for the annotations to be the final child on any given node. So the last sibling of the child. So that for any given AST node, right, we're expecting to find n things. And if we look at n plus 1, we find the annotations.
Would would child count now return plus one for everything, or would you keep child count pretending like the annotation was not a child? Like would we
be annotation might,
like a child, or just privately treating like a child?
I think you would have to accept that it was actually a child. Yeah. I mean,
I feel like there's a lot of places where we're looking at child count or doing like until AST sibling is null.
Yeah, there's a ton of that. There's a ton of that, and that could be problematic to change. If we were really brutal about it, actually, let me take that back, because that was a really bad idea. But maybe this is not as bad as I thought. Because annotated seek and annotated raw seek are the parser sort of types, parser definitions that take annotations.
So only those would have the possibility of an annotation.
And currently,
does that have a different TK type for it though?
Right now they're TK seek, but we could make them a TK annotated seek.
Yeah, or possibly have a flag for it.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good idea.
Add a flag, and the flag says that the last child is an annotation.
Yeah. That's not a bad idea. Although, maybe it would, that's hard to say, which is better. Because they're picked up in else clauses, the match else. Oh no, because there's also annotate annotations. Oh, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. That's not true. Huh. So there's actually a bunch of places where there are optional annotation.
Okay. Yeah.
Tons of them. Yeah. Nearly everywhere.
All right, I'll try to take some notes about what we talked about.
All right.
And refer anyone to think, look at the sync call if they need to.
Sounds good. On that note, we're out of time. Is there anything anyone really wants to cover in addition? Okay, cool. Thank you, everybody, and see you soon.